Blog Talk Radio.
Good evening, everyone. This is Carl Kafer, and this is the fourth ISF podcast. We're very, very happy to partner with ISF here on Deviant Legion. I also want to welcome back my co-host, who had a slight accident, and her cat was very, very naughty, but she's back. And so I want to welcome Corey back. It's nice to have you, my dear.
Thank you, darling. It's good to be back.
And tonight we're going to be talking to a gentleman that, if you take a look at his IMDb, it's like amazing. This man has been in the business since the early 70s and has produced in numerous films and different aspects, and we'll talk a little bit about what a producer is. But I want to welcome to the show Jefferson Richard. Jefferson, nice to have you with us, sir.
It's nice to be here. Haven't talked to you in a while.
No, it's been about a year or so at least.
About a year. We did a couple of shows. Yeah,
we did a couple of shows with my former partner, Stephen Ron Keough. And by the way, I do hear he's a little under the weather, so we hope that he's feeling better. So I got hooked up here at ISF, and it's really nice to have you back. And so just tell us a little bit about how you got into business and how you started out as a producer, and what the different types of producers are, because there's a line producer, there's an executive, whatever the case would be. So give us a little input.
Well, it's interesting you asked that question, because I recently did a little seminar at the Kanab Film Festival, the second annual Kanab Film Festival, exactly on that subject. And it's, you know, the title gets thrown around a lot. Now, there are producers that get a title because of one thing or the other. And then there are producers that work their ass off. And that would be my case, although you couldn't tell it by my size, but that's a joke. But, I started out actually as an actor and a musician. And I studied acting and I studied radio. I was in radio for a number of years in the Boston area. And then when I went to L.A., I was acting in a repertory company. And that was really hard work, you know, doing a show every night in a different town. We were on the road, and it was 1967, so you can imagine the summer of love. It was quite a trip. And we started to get into the independent movie industry about 1970, 1971, and I started out in a real low budget nudie cuties, they called them. They were similar to your stuff that's on late night on Showtime or
Cinemax. Cinemax. Exactly.
Cinemax. That's what I'm thinking of.
I'm well aware of the
nudie
kind cuties.
Of stuff, basically.
Yeah, it was hardcore porn, and they played at the Pussycat Theaters before the Pussycat Theaters went hardcore. And we made a lot of fun little pictures, and I just wanted to act. So I was an actor who I was a guy, like I was a bookie or something. And then they said, okay, but if you want to be in it, then you have to, like, grip or be a key grip or something. So, okay, I'll be the key grip. So then I was doing that for a while, and I did pretty much every job on the set, lighting and key grip and stuff like that. And I went, this is hard work. I don't want to walk around like this and do this shit all day long. So we can swear on this show, right?
Yes, you can swear.
Yeah.
Okay, all right. So I looked over, and there was this guy yelling at everybody, telling us what to do. And I was the first AD, and I said, that's what I want to do. I want to be the guy that stands around and yells at everybody. So that's basically how I got into it. That's a true story, man. So
I
Matt
like you
Simber
already.
Comes along, and somehow Matt Simber found out about me, and he hired me to be the first AD and the production manager and pretty much the line producer and everything else. And the second AD and the second AD, and, you know, it was very low budget stuff we were doing. And we did the Black Six, which is a classic, of course.
And, we talked about that on the previous show because I'm such a Mean Joe Green fan.
Mean Joe Green was in it. And then we did Candy Tangerine Man, which is still, plays on Amazon. And we went from there, and somehow we did a film called Lady Coco with Lola Falana, which is a little bit more mainstream. Well, not really mainstream, but it was a little bit more than just a black exploitation film. So we did that picture. And then after that, Matt did a 180 or something, and all of a sudden he wanted to do artsy movies. And that's where Witch That Came Out of the Sea, which is actually the original title, came into play, starring Millie Perkins, who, of course, played Anne Frank and I think was nominated for an Academy Award for that role. Well, I'm sure she was, actually. I don't know if she won. And that's when things changed a lot with Matt and myself with our filmmaking. And on that one, originally Kenny Gibb was the director of photography, but unfortunately he did too much blow. So I brought in Dean Cundey, who was a friend of mine, who of course has 5 Academy Awards now and stuff. And he shot Witch That Came Out of the Sea, or From the Sea. What's it called, Corey? What did you say it was called?
The Witch Who Came From the Sea.
It is that. Came from the sea. Okay, yeah.
Came from the sea, yeah.
And it was a great experience. And, we had a big screening in Hollywood at the, I think it was at the Pantages. And, people came out of it saying, that's the sickest movie I've ever seen. It's really tame compared to stuff that's out now. But in 1973 or 4, whatever it was, that was like, wow, my God. But, but it did well.
Now you told a story on the previous podcast about Millie Perkins and how she got involved and that, because that, that's a real, real tough role.
Her boyfriend was Robert Tom, who wrote the script. And that's how she, she was involved. She campaigned to do the film. And Matt just happened to be in the right place at the right time to get that information. I'm not sure what I said previously, but something like that.
Yeah.
And she was really into it. I mean, that she really wanted to do that film.
Yeah.
And she sells it, too. She's so good in that film. And she's very, very underrated, I think, as an actress. She was in one of Monty Hellman's films. Was that Roger Warren or The Shooting, I think. But just a great actress.
Yeah. Well, like I say, I know she was nominated for The Diary of Anne Frank. Now, whether it was a Academy Award or a Golden Globe or whatever, but she definitely was nominated. And she was a wonderful, wonderful girl to work with. I did something else with her, and I can't remember what it was. Isn't that weird? I know I did another film with her at some point where she had a small role. There's so many.
Well, you've done a lot of films.
Some of it blends together. Well, actually, I did 200 projects, individual projects, and that does not include episodes because I've done a number of TV series, and I'm just talking about, I'm counting that as one project, even though there were 24 episodes or whatever. So, yeah.
So I have a question for you. Now, some of our members would know who Matt Simber is, but Matt is, to me, is one of the great exploitation people and just independent people out there. And he did such good work. But one of the things that he was involved with, and I forgot to ask you this last time we talked, was, of course, the Gorgeous Ladies of Wrestling, otherwise known as Glory.
Yeah.
And, of course, they did a TV series on that. And, of course, he sort of represented. Did you have anything to do with that? Or had, at that point, had you gone to Sun Classics? And
No, at that point I was way beyond any of that. I was doing stuff for the studios and everything, but he and I did a film called Rigged in 84, I think we shot it. Yeah, and actually Matt was relieved of duty on that film, and they hired me to direct, and then I left, and it was a mess. Actually, the film's pretty good, but I mean, it is good. I like it, but I kind of bowed out of it with a lot of problems with the producer, who was also the executive producer, who was also the star. He actually wanted to direct the movie, and I said, "Yeah, go ahead, do it." I gotten tired, and I felt kind of weird betraying Matt on that, but what can I say? You know, I mean, they asked me, and I said, "Yeah, sure." And so Matt and I actually were kind of on the outs, but not really. We still talked and everything. And then he did Gorgeous Ladies of Wrestling, GLOW, the original GLOW, not the one that's on Netflix, which is about that. And the guy that's the manager, Matt Maron, I think his name is, plays the part,
right,
or is the role. That actually is supposed to be a Matt's Simber character, although Matt doesn't smoke or drink, but whatever, you know, they embellished it a bit. And Matt actually hates that. I talked to him about it. He hates that. So no, Sanford Hampton, who also has a large body of work, as it were, he did GLOW, and he did other stuff with Matt after that, because quite frankly, Matt and I still were friends and still are. But, you know, I'd move on to other things, and he still wanted to do stuff for $1 million and $500,000, and I was doing
right.
stuff for $30-40 million, so, you know.
Yeah, you know, and we'll get to that. You know, you definitely produced some major films.
I did all of Matt's movies except for his feature films, except for three. So there was one before I was involved with him when he did with his wife, Jane Mansfield. And then I did every other film except the Yellow Hair, which was just a scheduling problem. I was they were doing that in Spain, and I think I was in Mexico or something. I just wasn't available. And the GLOW series, and then he did another project with Sanford, Mariana or something, with a young wrestling girl.
Yeah.
I don't remember the project. Yeah. But yeah, I was involved with everything Matt did. We did between theater and, we did theater together too, and movies. I did, I think I was involved with like 20 projects in some stages of development. He and I were total partners on everything.
And one other thing we want to mention before, you know, getting away from that is Butterfly.
I was just going to say that.
Okay, so go ahead, Corey. I talk too much. You're my co-host. Go for it.
No, you certainly do not. But I think that film is particularly interesting because it's basically another take, a modern take on The Postman Always Rings Twice. Is that right?
No, it's actually written by the same man, James Cain.
Okay.
And it was a book by James Cain, Butterfly. And we did the adaptation, the film adaptation. And, of course, Orson Welles was one of the stars, which is
NPR.
One of my great experiences NPR. In life because he and I became friends, and I developed a bunch of projects with him and Gary Graver for a number of years. It was very exciting.
Was that your first project with Orson Welles, or is that had you been
working
with him for a while?
That's the first time I ever met him. And when
Matt told me
he had landed Orson Welles, I was floored, man. I said, "You're kidding," because the guy was always my idol. I grew up watching Citizen Kane over and over and over and over. I still watch it every time I can. And, that was the first time I met Orson and worked with him. And And we were like bosom buddies, two peas in a pod, or whatever you want to say. I mean, his thinking on filmmaking was exactly my thinking on filmmaking. And he was very enamored with me. However, he didn't have any money, so yeah, I worked for free, but I didn't care. He bought me lunch at Mama's Fawn every Wednesday. We went to eat prime rib at Mama's Fawn. That was enough payment, and drink some nice wine. Not the shit that he peddled on TV for money, but real wine, you know. For those of you that don't know, Mama's Fawn was a very exclusive restaurant in L.A. that you had to have a reservation. And in order to get a reservation, you had to have the phone number, which was unlisted. So someone had to give it to you. And then once you had the number, you would call. And then the owner, whose name escapes me at the moment, a French fellow, he would verify everything before you were allowed to make the reservation. He would make sure you really were somebody, as it were. And it was a wonderful restaurant. It was down in the Melrose, and it was, everyone was there. You know, every creative mind in L.A. ate at Mama Son. It was fabulous.
Now, those are the type of memories that just make your life. You know, that when you go to dinner with someone like that, or whatever the case would be. For me, it's talking to you guys. You know, I mean, this is great to do, and those are the memories we have on working on projects. So anyway,
go ahead.
No, go ahead.
You know me, I just babble forever unless you stop and ask me questions. I'll just keep yakking.
So,
as Bob Dylan would say, with no direction known. So,
like a rolling stone. With Matt. Then, you know, there's so much that you did. Just give us a couple of films that... experiences and stories of some of the other films that you worked on and that you think our listeners would be interested in.
Well, the other person that was really responsible, Matt, was, like, I would say Bethel Buckaloo, who did the Nudie Cuties. He was responsible for me learning how to make movies, because I had no idea. I just knew how to do plays. I did plays really well. I knew that. But I don't know anything about movies. So by working on those Harry Novak-produced Nudie Cuties, the Pig Keeper's Daughter and that nonsense, I learned the basics of how to make a film. He showed me how to break down a script, how to schedule it, how to budget. He showed me how to figure out how to shoot all locations in one day and jump around and go back and make sure you had continuity with the costumes and the makeup. I would know nothing if I did not go to film school. I went to school for broadcasting and acting. So that was actually my film school. And then working with Matt was a great experience. And the other fellow that I worked with was, of course, Don Carmody, who's ahead of Hollywood North up there in Toronto, and he got into doing low-budget stuff first. He was sent down to be the representative from a Canadian company called DAL Productions, which eventually became Lionsgate, and we did a film called, I'm not supposed to tell anyone this, but Ilsa and the Oil Sheiks. Here and keep
your
oil.
I know that one. Oh, yeah.
Yeah. Pretty strange sick
film.
Beautifully done. Beautifully done.
Set, I think. Was that the one that was filmed on a Hogan's Heroes set? Or no?
No, we built the... that was Ilsa Seawolf for the SS. That was the first one. I actually was involved with the first one, but very, very light involvement as a consultant, and I got paid a couple hundred bucks or something to find a location for him or something. But the second one, The Oil Sheiks, was directed by Don Edmonds, and another good friend of mine who passed a few years ago. And that was really interesting because we were making a torture film, low budget, but they wanted it to be like, you know, studio quality. They wanted it to be really good. So I got Dean Cundey to shoot it again, who is the guy that's now got all these Academy Awards, shot Back to the Future, all that stuff. Roger Rabbit, you know. And it turned out great. And the reason I got Dean is we had another guy that they wanted, and he was just, you know, he wasn't in sync with the director. So I asked Dean to come over, and he had a van called Movie Van, and he had a regular, like a nice little van. They'd all rigged out with, he had lenses, and he had gels and equipment and cameras in it. And so if we said, well, I need an IMO camera, I want to get this shot from underneath, you know, he'd say, okay, I got one right here. And then so I said, well, we got to fire this guy, because he's not doing the job. And Don hates him. And they said, well, okay, but who are you going to get to replace him? I said, Dean. You said, you mean the guy that's selling the supplies on the side on the stage there? I said, yeah, that guy. And so I said, Dean, you want to shoot the movie? How much does it pay? I told him, he said, okay. So I said, Rusty, you're fired. And then Dean had his own camera and everything. So he made money because, you know, we were renting all his equipment at that point. We could send back the other stuff. And that's how we got Dean Cundey to shoot Ilsa, harem keeper to the Oil Sheiks, which is pretty amazing. Which is why it's a quality film, you know, even though it is what it is. But I'll tell you, I'm sure there were fans out there because there were like, I think, 6 Ilsa movies made. And they're very, very popular. And they played at the local drive-ins, believe it or not, you know.
Oh, they did. Trust me, they did. No question.
Yeah.
I've worked in the drive-ins in the 70s. Oh, yeah. We ran the Ilsa films, without a doubt.
Yeah. And Don Carmody became more and more involved with mainstream stuff. We formed a company called Bay State Films because most people don't realize that he's actually from Massachusetts, even though he's also a Canadian. And we had a company called Bay State Films, and we started developing projects. And eventually, none of those projects actually got, we sold options and stuff, and, you know, had production deals, but a lot of them didn't get off the ground. But then he started to get more and more mainstream stuff like Porky's and eventually with all the studios. And then, because I had international experience with Simber, we did quite a few films in Europe. And Don said, well, you know all about Europe. So he had hired me to do the films with him in Europe. And so that's how I became like an international filmmaker. As a matter of fact, that was my specialty for many years, is doing films all over Europe and Mexico, Hong Kong, you know, anywhere. You need a movie made somewhere, they'd hire me, and I would go out and, you know, hire local guys, but be in charge. So I got a lot of mileage that way.
Mm-hmm. So a couple of films that I'm taking a look at, I just want to get your feedback on what you did with them and so on and so forth. Of course, we mentioned Larry Cohen, but you worked on Maniac Cop with him and Bill
Lustig. I produced Maniac Cop with Larry, and also was involved with Maniac Cop 2. And then I was the producer on Maniac Cop 2, and then it got put on hold because the financing didn't come through from the original source. And I think I went with either Matt I think it was Don Carmody took me over to Europe to do something, so I wasn't available. But I did work on Maniac Cop 2 for maybe about 6 months. And with Larry, and Larry was a great guy, man. I was really, really upset that at the award ceremonies they did not show Larry, you know, in memoriam.
You're not the only one.
Because
you're not the only one.
I think they considered him like a low budget dude. But, you know, he wrote Carrie, for God's sakes, and he wrote episodes of Gunsmoke. I mean, come on. This guy was a great writer.
Cornet Blue, you know, his TV work, It's Alive. The guy, he's one of my heroes. I grew up in the 80s in New York, and every year there was a Larry Cohen film that was running. And I loved him. Absolutely loved the man and loved his work.
And in recent years, he wrote Phone Booth, which was Colin Farrell's big introduction to the world. And I think he got nominated for it for some awards and stuff. I
think for the Golden Globe, actually. That script, from what I understand, had been around for quite a while. He tried to sell that to Hitchcock back in the 60s.
Uh-huh. Yep.
And so, you know, and then he also, Cellular was another one that he did. I forget who was in that. Was that whatever the case. But, yeah, Larry Cohen, big fan, and just I think he's really a fine gentleman. And of course, there's that documentary, too, King Cohen. If people have not seen it, they need to see it.
Yeah. So. I think your bird is going crazy, or your dog.
It happens. I just moved into a new neighborhood. So another one that I noticed was Sundown, the Vampire in Retreat. tell us a little bit about that.
That's one of my favorites. Anthony Hickox. Mm-hmm. And I had worked on a film called Night Stalker, which actually was Robert Zadar's first feature. Also Lydie Denier's first feature. And it starred my friend Charles Napier, of course. And mm-hmm. we did that film previous to Maniac Cop. And I'm getting mixed up. What was I talking about?
Night Stalker and the Vampire.
Sundown, the Vampire in Retreat.
Oh, yeah, the Vampire in Retreat. Jack Lorenz, who eventually was the head of Vestron Pictures, he was a PA on that film. He was a recovering alcoholic, which he'll tell you. He's not shy about that. That's no secret. And the guy, Bob, I think his name is Bob Christie. He was the executive producer, the money guy. And he wanted me to hire Lorenz, who was his bartender at his restaurant in Beverly Hills. And I said, sure, I'll give him a job, you know. And Jack turned out to be great, man. He was a great learner. He learned everything. Knew how to make films. He just one of those people that's like instant, yeah, okay, he's great. So he calls me a few years later, and he says, well, I'm now the president of Vestron Pictures, along with your friend Don Ireland. I said, Don Ireland? Dan Ireland is the head? Oh, yeah, we're heads. And I said, okay. And we got a movie called Sundown, and we want to do it in Utah. And I said, well, I've done a lot of stuff in Utah. I can arrange that. So he told me about Anthony Hickox, who, of course, is Sir Douglas Hickox's son, and also heir to Hammer Films. He owns Hammer Films now. And Ann Coates is his mother, the great film editor. And I said, all right, I'll work with this guy. So we went to Moab, Utah. And Hickox says, well, I don't fly. I don't fly. I came over on the Queen Mary, and I refused to fly. Okay, man, whatever. So we got him a train ticket. At that time, there was actually a train that went from L.A. I guess you made a connection in Vegas or something, and it went to Green River, Utah. I said, okay, we'll pick you up at the train station. So this guy comes out. I never met him. I just talked to him on the phone. He comes out with his nose in the air doing his Anthony Hickox act. waving to people from the platform as the train comes in. It was unbelievable. He was a great guy, and we made this vampire picture, which is quite unique because it's a Western as well as a vampire picture. And had David Carradine in it. And it's the redemption of the vampires. They get redeemed in it. And, you know, of course, Bruce Campbell was in it. It was a great cast. David Carradine, I said.
And it's a wonderful film. If people don't know it, they need to see it. It's a great take on vampires and a very unique film. And one of my favorites, too.
It's like a vampire Western comedy. I mean, it's so many things in one. And it's got a great soundtrack. Richie Stone did the soundtrack for me. And he's like, you know, did Platoon, you know.
Mm-hmm.
This guy's a great composer. He passed away a number of years ago because he had a habit of drinking too much, but killed his liver.
But those things happen.
Yeah.
But any Bruce Campbell fan cannot miss that movie. I mean, it's just, it's fun.
Yeah, he's great in that film. And, of course, I did Maniac Cop with him, too. So Bruce and I were pretty tight for years, along with Leo Rossi.
You mentioned Leo Rossi. And, of course, you mentioned Charles Napier. Now, I just want you to know, if I ever got Leo Rossi on this thing, I would be total fanboy. I love that man. I think he's one of the most underrated character actors out there.
Yeah. You know, the first time I met Leo, which I totally forgot about, I did all these films with him in the 80s and early 90s, and I didn't realize he was the same guy because then you didn't have IMDb. You couldn't look up shit, you know. And, well, I guess you could if you paid or something, but I don't care about it. In 72, 73, 74, something like that, Matt and I did a film called Cherry Hill Fats, alias Big Cherry. It was based on a book about this 500-pound guy. This is a true story. 500-pound guy in New Jersey who was a con man that scammed millions of dollars from all kinds of investments, and there were all kinds of scams he did to make millions of dollars. So we had to find an actor that weighed 500 pounds and could act. So this agent came to us, and he said, there's this guy in Philadelphia. He's fantastic. He's got the Eastern accent, the whole thing. So they send this guy out. And he literally weighs, well, I don't know, he may not have weighed 500 pounds, but he weighed, I know what I weigh, and he weighed like at least 4 or 450, this guy. Huge fat guy. I can say that because I'm a fat guy. I can use those terms. Yeah. It's like the black comedians can say, you know, what they say, and that's fine because they're black. I can say that because I'm a fat guy. Anyway, he comes out. And they say, well, we got to have someone drive him around because he can't drive. He doesn't know anything about it. You can't rent him a car. So Buck Flower, of course, famous character actor.
Another great name, of course, Buck Flower.
Yes. I love him.
Who's also my brother-in-law. But he got the job of driving him around. And, of course, Buck had this little Japanese car, so it was really comical. Buck was going, he's going to break my springs. So we do this whole movie. So now years later, we're doing Hit List, Maniac Cop. We're doing all these Hit Lists we were doing. And they wanted Leo Rossi. And I said, oh, okay. Didn't even dawn on me it was the same guy, because he didn't want longer weighed 450, 500 pounds. And so I don't know what we did. I think I did 4 or 5 pictures with him. And he was great. I mean, he's like one of the best. It just dawned on me a few years ago that it was the same guy. So I called him up and I said, Leo, why is it you didn't recognize me when I know I didn't recognize you because you lost all that weight? And he said, well, I didn't recognize you because you gained all that weight. You were a skinny guy back in 1974. I said, oh, that's true. He had realized it too at some point years later, you know, going, wait a minute, that's just, because now we all had IMDb, and he's going, that's the same guy. Said, well, how would I recognize you? You were a skinny guy. I said, oh, no.
Yeah. Excuse me, everyone. Do you have a caller?
Okay, fair enough.
I'll pull them in the system right now.
One. Hello, everyone.
Hello.
Jeff Sparks here. Hello. Hey there.
Hey,
oh, Jeff.
How are you, man?
I'm doing good. Great conversation, you guys. Wondering about your days with... What's that?
You ready to buy your coffee, Berserker?
I was wondering, actually, about your times with Grizzly Adams. I really loved that show growing up. And it looks like you worked for Sun for a while. And just would love to hear about that show and what it was like to be up in the mountains doing that.
Or Dunn Classic, as it says on your website.
Yeah, right.
Well, it's called autocorrect. Give me a break, Jefferson. Good Lord.
So I remember my time well at Dunn Classic. Don Dunn was the head of the company. No. I got hired. It's really a weird thing. That whole thing came out of nowhere. I was doing, believe it or not, I was doing a play in L.A. that Matt produced. And I directed, and it was I forget the name. It was a Little Bo Peep, anyway. And I played a magician that came out and introduced it. And Loreen Landon played Little Bo Peep. And it was a little musical play for kids that we did at, what's that season called in L.A.? It's like after Christmas and New Year's. It's like 2 weeks where it always rains. We did it then. Yeah, we did it then, and we did like 5 shows a day for little kids, and everyone got paid $5 a piece to do a show or whatever. It was a lot of fun. And I said, all right, that's it. And I went back home, back to Massachusetts, because I moved out to Massachusetts to help my dad with his business. And I got in the house. I sat down. My wife made me dinner. I was eating dinner, and I got a phone call. And it was from Henning Schullerup, who was the DP and that I had worked with years before. And he said, I have a job for you. I said, oh? He said, yeah, I need you to come to Texas tomorrow. I said, tomorrow? I said, I can't go tomorrow. I can go next week. He said, all right, next week. And you'll be the first AD on this picture for Sun Classic, In Search of the Bermuda Triangle. I said, okay, that sounds good. So I went and, you know, got my affairs in order, as they say, and they sent me a ticket, and I went down there, and I did this In Search of the Bermuda Triangle. And they said, well, we really like your style, and we'd like you to continue with us. And I said, oh, that's nice. So they brought me to Utah, moved me up to Park City, and they, at that time, they had a great program where they brought in professionals from L.A. or, you know, the professional community. And they paid us whatever in the day it was, and, you know, whatever was good for the day. And we were on a permanent salary every week, and you got insurance, and they even helped me buy a house, everything.
Wow.
And everything. Company car, they gave you everything. And your job was to make all these movies and TV shows for NBC, because they had a big contract with NBC.
Okay.
And
sure.
And we trained all these cowboys, they call them the Camas Cowboys from the Camas Valley, to be technicians, gaffers, and electricians, and sound guys.
Oh, that's incredible.
A lot of them are still working in the business now. Like Ian Kincaid's one of the highest paid gaffers in the business, but he's still working. He was trained by me.
And he was a cowboy.
Yeah.
That's cool.
Yeah,
wow.
He's one of the Camas Cowboys.
Neat.
Oh, yeah, and that's where Grizzly Adams came in, because they had Grizzly Adams on the air, and I actually was hired to do movies of the week, but they had me do second unit, because I had second unit directing experience, and that's what I did on Grizzly Adams. We did the shots of the animals and the eagles flying and beavers frolicking and things like that. Oh, no, that was the pornos I did. I can't remember. But anyway.
Your career sounds a lot like Gary Graver's, actually. He kind of went both ways as well. He wasn't too very talkative about it, but I definitely heard stories about him working on a porn in the morning and then working with Gary Coleman on a TV movie in the afternoon, you know?
You know, like, it was so different then
right,
than it is now.
Right.
It was a learning experience, you know? It wasn't like
well,
it is now where
it's
a huge industry.
For a second. The whole thing about the porn industry, particularly in the East Coast, is it was a way of learning film. I mean, you know,
right.
There were so many people involved, Sean Cunningham Wes Craven. All these guys did.
Bill Lustig.
You didn't know Wes Craven. Wow. That's cool.
Everybody did. It was a learning experience. That's how you learned how to make movies.
Roger Corman school. Instead of Roger Corman, it was whoever was producing those.
And I'm not kidding about that either. That was really a school for a number of filmmakers.
That's really an interesting subject matter. I love
that.
That's really interesting. Wow.
You're not
gonna
get
I actually have a few friends that came up to
learning,
that.
Say that again, Corey. We missed it.
You're not going to get shamed out of the business for doing it the way. I mean, we're so puritanical about it now, but it was different back then. It's unfortunate.
Sure.
It's not the same way.
Well, you know what, Corey? Everything was totally different. So the world was different. Life was different. Everything was just different. I mean, it was just different. I can't even explain it to people now, because you had to be there. You can watch a movie about
exactly.
it. You can watch a movie about
there.
The 60s or 70s, but forget it. You had to be there. Yeah.
Wow.
Yeah. Oh,
man.
I wish I was.
So did you work much with Gary Graver at all, with Orson?
I never actually worked with Gary. Well, no, wait.
Okay.
I did. He came on and did some shooting on something I was doing.
Sure.
We talked a lot. I'm not even sure if he remembers our conversations. He went in one direction, I went in another, so, you know.
Sure.
But
did you ever hear about The Other Side of the Wind? That was a story. I heard a lot about that film, making that film.
Oh, yeah, I know all
Gary.
About that. I know all about that.
Yeah.
It's actually
absolutely.
Very good if you've seen it.
Oh, I have seen it. It's
finally
excellent.
Finished. Yeah.
Yep. I'm so happy it finally got finished. Yeah. It's amazing that Netflix ended up being the ones that did it. But
I actually contributed quite a bit of money to the cause
really?
At one point to
awesome.
To restore stuff and find footage
absolutely.
And all that.
Keep
I
it going,
did,
yeah.
Within a couple of years, I think it was about 25,000 myself
wow.
and my group put up for it, yeah.
Wow, well, thank you, because the
means,
film's
which
amazing
means I get
to
a
see,
check
and
when it showed.
I'd love to see it in the theater, actually, at some point. That would be nice.
Yeah, that would be
see
great.
The screen in the theater, you know, because that's the way it's supposed to be. But, maybe someday we can do that.
All right, so I think it's now time that we talk about Berserker, because it's the one film directed and got 2-3 copies. So let's go for it, Jefferson.
Berserker is a film I did in 1980-something. And
it was
a theatrical feature, and it starred John Goff and Buck Lauer, and it was also Shannon Ingemann was in it, who was Larry King's sister-in-law now, or was until about a year ago, and Beth Toussaint, who was, you see her on all kinds of shows from the 80s, Matlock, Dallas, everything. Anyway, we shot it up here in Utah, and it was my take on horror films with sort of a camp twist. They called me the Ingmar Bergman of camp when it came out. That was in Fangoria, I think, the reviewer. And we did a remastered Blu-ray, which is gorgeous. It looks incredible. We mixed it into surround sounds, which it was not originally. And it's absolutely beautiful. And I have got personally inscribed. I will personally inscribe the DVD Blu-ray version. It's $25, and you can Venmo me at Jefferson Richard at Jefferson-Richard, or PayPal me. It's memonk@aol.com, or Cash App is $JeffersonRichard, and you can do it with your credit card or whatever with your account, and I will be glad to send you a copy. Just send me your name and address and your phone number, and it'll be on its way. And it's just beautiful. And it was done in conjunction with Vinegar Syndrome. It's on Vinegar Syndrome. And, you know, and just let me know what you want me to write on it. And I will, you know, write to my biggest fan or my best friend or whatever you want. I don't know. But $25, it's a good deal. And there's a lot of extras. And my interview is worth the price of admission alone. So, you know.
Mm-hmm.
So anyway,
we'll put this
25
information up on ISF too.
What's that?
Say that again, Corey.
I was going to say we can put your website up and everything on ISF after the podcast, of course, too. But
okay, yeah, you
so
can put that,
can
all those things up
access,
there, and they
yeah.
can know. Cool. Yeah, I mean, it's really, I was so impressed. Really was. They did such a beautiful job. And it was a theatrical feature, and it has a large following. I think they sold out, when it first came out on Halloween, they sold like 1,000 copies in 24 hours or something, so which was amazing.
Nice.
For a first time.
Yeah, it's a bona fide cult classic for sure. So what inspired you to make the film? I mean, it's about the berserker, the Viking thing and all that, so
it was
why
a weird story. I got a phone call out of the clear blue. There's a guy that had been involved with the financing of another film I did with Joe Tonatori, which was codenamed Zebra. And he called me and he said, I got these guys down in Santa Monica and they want to make a horror film. And I said, oh, okay. So I went down there. He said, I got an idea. It's got to be like about berserkers. And I said, okay, I don't know what that is, but I looked it up and found out what a berserker was. And I went in and I put together a pitch. And I said, well, look, I can get Bart the Bear in the film, Doug Seuss and Bart the Bear, who, of course, has an Academy Award for The Bear, the movie The Bear, the French film. And I said, you know, I got the bear. And I got this, and I showed them pictures of the bear, and I talked about it for like 10 minutes. I wrote out a little presentation. They said, well, it's up to Buffy. I said, okay. So I look over, and there's mafia-looking guy, Buffy Buffalino, of the Buffalino family, sitting in the corner. Now, these guys were into gay porn. That's what they were doing at the time. But they wanted to get into legitimate stuff. Yeah. So they said, it's up to Buffy, and he says, I like the bear. Let's do it.
Wow.
That was it. I said, okay, now I got to come up with a script, right? So I go back to Utah, and I go down by the river, and I'm fishing, and I got my little, you know, like you used to have these little tape recorders. You push a button, you can talk, and, you know, dictating type thing. I sat there, and I just wrote a treatment. And I went back to the house and I sat at my old typewriter and sat there and just started typing, listening to my treatment. And I came up with an 89-92 page script. I turned it in 2 days later and he said, okay, when can you start? And I said, well, we'll start pre-production next week. He said, okay. It was so smooth. It was crazy.
Wow.
So we get up there. My people are here. I used all my local crew from Sun Classic. I had my niece come up to do the special effects makeup. She's from L.A. and Buck Flower's daughter, actually. And had my wife do the costumes, and it was crazy. Everyone was here, and then I looked in the bank account, and there wasn't any money. So that's a problem. So I had a little argument with the boys, but they eventually sent the money, and as usual, I sucked it up and just, you know, fronted the money for everyone, and I got paid back handsomely.
Wow.
So what do I care? handsomely. In those days, I thought I died and went to heaven, but, you know, they actually paid me. But that's how it got made, and it was just, like, so fast and quick. And I had an agent at that time, and she went in and pounded out a deal, which was probably not the best deal in the world, but at that point, as a director, it was a good deal, you know, because it basically was my second or third time I was directing a feature. It wasn't like something I was doing all the time, you know.
Yeah.
So that was good. And that's it.
Buck Flower was my favorite character.
Great story, Jefferson. That's just a great story. So to finish up, I just want to go a little further down the line and talk about your work in the 90s and 2000s, and particularly like becoming the line producer on Get Carter and 3,000 Miles to Graceland and Driven, and working with Sylvester Stallone and all that sort of good stuff.
Yeah. That was great. You know, that's all Don Carmody stuff with Franchise Pictures and Warner Brothers. We did all those for Warner Brothers. And they were, you know, Get Carter, I think, I can't remember exactly. I think it was about $44 million. And Driven was actually $62 million. And Graceland was around $45 million. I also worked on The Pledge with Sean Penn, that directed.
Awesome
and
movie.
Jack Nicholson starred in. Yeah. And
that was a great one.
That was all with Don Carmody. We did all those films within a period of like a year and a half. I mean, they're all being done at the same time, sort of. And I just bounced around from one to the other. It was quite a good time. And then I also did a lot of stuff with Sony after that. And in the 2000s, which was, you know, I was very proud of those films, Bloody Mary, Urban mm-hmm. Legends, Bloody Mary, and I'll Always Know What You Did Last Summer, which actually was just on last night. I was watching it on Showtime. And Daddy Day Camp, which was a huge theatrical release, which got terrible reviews, and I think very... very, very wrong. I mean, the thing still plays today. As a matter of fact, that's one of the ones I get the biggest checks from because it's so popular on, you know, all over the world. So,
mm-hmm.
once again, yeah. The critics are wrong.
No, you know what? Critics are critics. It's what people like. You know, you take a look at anything that you've done or any films, you know, there's always going to be someone that champions them. You know, and that's who the movies are made for. Seriously.
I got into this the other day on Facebook because I think, what's his name? John Cleese or Terry Gilliam, one of them, was talking about how the critics are just, you know, they hate everything. And I said, they go into it with the wrong attitude. First of all, when you go in, if you're going to be a real critic like Roger Ebert, you go in with the attitude, okay, this is going to be great. And then you start to come down from there. These guys these days, these young guys, young and some old, go in and they say, well, this is going to be stupid. And then they go down from there instead of giving the film a chance. You know, immediately with Daddy Day Camp, it can't be any good because Eddie Murphy isn't in it. Well, it wasn't ever designed for Eddie Murphy. We didn't have $50 million to make it. You know, we had $5 million to make it. So we had Cuba Gooding. What's wrong with Cuba Gooding? He's an Academy Award nominated actor, right? I mean, you know.
Yeah.
And the guy that played his partner, John Goodman, actually selected him and said, no, this is my guy. Have him play it. So that's a stupid thing to go with in the first place, and that's what they based the film on. Well, how come Eddie Murphy wasn't in it? You know, it's like stupid. I mean, I've seen a lot of sequels where someone else was a star instead of the original guy, and they were better films than the original one.
Yeah.
One other question before we wrap up here is if there was a movie that you have worked on that you feel that more people need to see and that you were pleased with the film,
what would that film be?
Let me think about that one. Rigged? Rigged? That one, okay. I think, is a very good film. That's the one that Matt directed, and then I directed, and then Sanford directed, and the editor got the credit. But I have no hard feelings on it. That was a good film. And I don't think it was seen by hardly anybody, I mean, really. Mm-hmm. The other one that I think is... I think Butterfly, really. I think that one, everyone should see Butterfly. Butterfly is a brilliant film. I mean, we got nominated for three Golden Globes, one. You know, it was not a shabby movie.
Mm. No, I love that movie.
I think that would be it. Yeah, well, you've seen it, but I mean, it's, I mean, not the general public. I mean, I think people need to see these films. But if I must say, I think one of my best movies, which I do not have the main directing credit on, however, at the end it does say additional scenes by... which is bullshit because I directed the whole movie, but that's another story. is Massacre Mafia Style.
It's
a film I did. You know that film? Yeah.
Do I know that film? I fucking love that film.
Yeah, well, I directed that movie, and then Duke Mitchell took over, and I don't know, he went crazy, and he wrote all these reviews about how brilliant he was and said he produced and directed and all. He didn't do any of that. He starred in it and he wrote it. But other than that, which is okay. I mean, you know, Duke had some ego problems, but
the God, you got to love Duke Mitchell. Just trust me on this.
Course,
you got to love
you
him.
Know? No, he's my buddy, but you know, he just had his thing going on. It's my movie. He was standing on top of a chair. I said, yeah, but it's still time for lunch, dude, you know. So, yeah. No, it's time. It's 6.5 hours. We've got to eat lunch now. Then we'll shoot your scene afterwards. But, and that film, I think, I watched it recently. I think you – no, it wasn't you. It was another fellow that I did a podcast with that had seen it. And it was on Amazon. I don't know if it's still running, but it's that's a good film, and I think people should see that. It's Tarantino based the structure of Pulp Fiction on it. I'm watching TV one night, and he's on The Tonight Show, and he's talking about how, well, there's this movie, Massacre Mafia Style, and I based the structure of starting at the end and then going back to the beginning, ending up at the end. And I was going, wait a minute, I directed that movie. What's going on here? But you know, as you know, I know Tarantino because he used to be the guy at Dave's video store. He was my video store guy. You know, where I got my videos back
really?
In the old days.
That's hilarious.
Yeah,
that's
how I got involved with True Lies. You know, so.
Oh, no kidding.
So one other film I have to champion of yours that you worked on. And you got to realize I'm a huge James Glickenhaus fan. And that would be Slaughter of the Innocents, which I think
I mean, you know, we're talking about classic shit there, man. That's a great movie.
Fucking great film. Seriously, if you have not seen Slaughter of the Innocents, find it, watch it, period.
I didn't even get time to talk about Glickenhaus.
I
worked with Glickenhaus for 5 or 6 years. I didn't even talk about him, did I?
No. So tell us just a little bit about working with Glickenhaus, because I love his stuff in the 90s. Seriously.
Well, of course, I did Maniac Cop, which was the first Shapiro Glickenhaus production. And then after that, when we were doing Maniac Cop, he went to New York and he was shooting Shakedown. And he used my guys. We went out and we shot the second unit on the big roller coaster scene. All that stuff I shot with my guys, second unit.
Wow.
And the whole chase on the roller coaster. Because I had done one in previous years. I had done one on a little film we did outside of San Francisco. In Santa Cruz, we shot a roller coaster scene. We had us do it. But then after that, I did Slaughter of the Innocents. and then we did the sword fighting picture. What's the name of that thing? I can't remember the name of it. And then Time Master. And yeah, it was a thrill, man, working with Jim.
Yeah, really, really fine stuff. So anyway, we're near the end here. Why don't you give us one more shout out on Berserker, so people
can
do it.
Watch on your screen. We'll post the everything on your bottom of your screen, folks. Oh no, we're on the radio. Venmo Jefferson Richard at Jefferson-Richard. PayPal, SmeMonk, S-M-E-M-O-N-K, at AOL.com, PayPal. Cash App, $ Jefferson Richard, and it's $25. Give me your name, address, of course, your credit card or your PayPal account or whatever, and your phone number, and I will ship it out to you. And I will tell me what you want written on it, and I will write it out and sign it. And someday it'll be worth probably you $5 on
eBay.
eBay, that's what I was trying to think of. Yeah.
Well,
anyway, you get my autograph and you get the video, and it's really worth it. The extras are worth it.
Of course, you can do the interview too, and then you can do the interview and then listen to the podcast afterwards. You know, there you go.
That'd be great.
Okay.
Yeah.
So, I want to thank you very, very much for being on. It's a pleasure, man. And we'll definitely have you on again if you wish, because you're a great guest.
Absolutely. Anytime, man. You know.
Okay.
Mr. Richard, it was lovely to meet you, sort of, you know, on the radio anyway.
Well, as long as I don't have to wear pants, I'm cool.
Well, you know, nobody needs to wear pants doing a podcast. No, none of us are wearing pants. Not that. Back, so there you go.
Yeah, exactly. I wonder if Savannah Guthrie wears pants when she's on the Today Show from her house. I have this vision of her sitting there with no pants on.
Nope. We're all hoping she's not wearing pants.
Have a little slippers
okay,
on.
Okay. Enough of the fantasies here.
Oh, listen up, Carl. My goodness.
My next
so
film.
Anyway, just to let people know, we are going on Deviant Legion. We have a show on Friday, Adam Perrins, with a couple of guests, and they're going to be talking about the films of Stanley Kubrick. This Sunday, Doc, are you with us, or should I say this?
Yes, I'm
I guess
here.
He's not with us. Oh, okay.
No,
you want
I'm
to
here.
Talk about
yeah.
what you're doing today?
Yes. Well, first of all, I have to say I'm not wearing any socks.
Because they're so boring.
I had to.
Are your toes manicured,
yeah.
though?
well, this Sunday on the Flood Pit, we'll be talking about band films that are kind of hard to explain this one, but I'll just go for it. We're going to be speaking about films that have been banned for religious reasons by organizations like the ones from the 80s or, you know, like different...
Yeah, with the League of Decency, all that sort of good stuff.
Yep. Uh-huh. Yep. So Monty Python's Life of Brian will be talked about. So that's what we're going to be doing Sunday, 8 o'clock.
Okay, and next Tuesday, I'd like to announce our guest on the next ISF podcast, and that's going to be the incredible madman known as Mark Pirro of Pirro Mount Films. The best thing I can say is, let's see, Death Row Game Show, Polish Vampire in Burbank, Curse of the Square Wolf, and my all-time favorite film of his, actually two. One is Nudist Colony of the Dead, which is a musical, by the way. And finally, think of a kaiju film, a Japanese kaiju film called Rectuma. And Corey, you actually saw the trailer to that, did you not?
Yeah.
And did you laugh your ass off?
No comment.
I definitely did.
Very good, Jefferson. Very good.
Queer Wolf is the great film. Yeah. Werewolf is a real trip, man. I got to tell you.
Mark is one of the funniest people. He really is the wonderful thing about Mark is, you know, it's lowbrow humor, but he's really smart about it. He's really smart about it. And so it works both ways. And we're going to have him on next week. So I'm very pleased with that. Jefferson, again, I want to say thank you so much for being on, man. This has been
my pleasure.
All right. Well, fair enough, folks. Thank you very much for listening. And we'll see you next week on the ISF podcast. Thank you very much. Everyone say good night.
Good night.
Good night.
Good night.
Good night.
Thanks, Jefferson, very, very much. Thank you, Jeff, for calling in.
Good
night.
Bye.